Welcome to Money and Racism, the podcast that delves deep into the intersection of finance and racial disparities. I'm your host and money EQ specialist, Dr. Joe Burns. I'm here to guide you through a series of thought-provoking conversations with people of color that aim to uncover the intricate relationships between money and systemic racism. Whether you're curious about the subject, seeking insights, or ready to join the fight against systemic injustices, money and racism is your space to learn, discuss, and take action. So, join us every week as we engage in free-flowing conversations that challenge the status quo and encourage critical thinking. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world. On today's episode, we have Dr. Vanessa M. Perry. She is an organizational psychologist, executive coach, author, and thought leader in organizational development and leadership. As the CEO of Health Resources Solution, she assists organizations in creating long-term transformational change through a racial equity lens. By working in partnership with managers, directors, and C-suite executives, she assists them in delivering real impact to their customers and clients. Dr. Vanessa has over 25 years of experience positioning organizations for growth by providing vision, strategy, and operational execution. Working with government, corporate, and nonprofit organizations, she has extensive experience in domestic and international policy, diversity, equity, and inclusion, organizational change, leadership development, and evaluation. Dr. Vanessa's research interest is Black women's experiences with gendered racism and how to create psychological safety and well-being in the workplace. She is often asked to give keynotes and facilitate training on Black women, DEI, and leadership. Dr. Vanessa is the author of the forthcoming book, The Path to Inclusivity, How to Create Safety, Well-being, and Belonging for Black Women in Financial Services. Please help me welcome today, Dr. Vanessa Perry. So welcome, Dr. Vanessa Perry. Like, this is amazing. When I first talked to you about doing this podcast with me, I couldn't have asked for a better subject because I know, like, I read your bio, you do a lot of DEI work, a lot of organizational stuff, right, for corporations. And you're like, oh, hey, I'm also researching and I'm going to be writing this book. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like that's the perfect subject to talk about for this. So I'm just super excited to have you here today and just talk to you about this because it's obviously a fascination of mine, right? That's why I'm doing this whole show. And then to have experts like you on here who are actually like diving in, doing the research and writing publications on this, right, that people can go and read is just more than I could ever ask for. So thank you so much for being on here today and super excited to have this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Talk to me. Since I haven't read the book because you don't have it published it yet, what's it about? Like, what's that overview? And there's a lot of questions I have about it.
So I did a research study looking at Black women managers in financial services and the challenges that they have around getting from usually from middle manager above in financial services. And so the name of the book is called The Path to Inclusivity, How to Create Safety, Well-being, and Belonging for Black Women in Financial Services. And, you know, the goal of this book really is to offer unique insights, you know, inspiration and empowerment for Black women in financial services. So there are lots of in-depth interviews that talk about the challenges that they face navigating racism and sexism in corporate America, the challenges that they have as it relates to being middle managers and getting above, and then the ways in which they really are resisting societal norms to be able to bring their authentic selves to the workplace. It's a comprehensive book. It's got a lot of different pieces. These are women who are in an industry that has been predominantly white, that have the opportunity to decrease the wealth gap based on where they are. However, they don't always necessarily have the opportunities to get to the next level because of some of the barriers that are within the organizations.
I can definitely see that. There's a lot of history about the financial industry that a lot of us don't know, right? And that's kind of what started my journey into this whole conversation of money racism from the work I do and having coaches push me to be like, oh, you should go check this out about what's available there. Because I was not shameless to say this anymore, but I was super ignorant about like the whole history of Black Americans in the financial industry. There's so much there that you could really dive into. And there's so much history that has chosen to be forgotten about.
Sure.
Right. You know, you see like what you're talking about here, things that are still happening today that were started way back, like at the end of the slavery period and all that, that never changed. And a lot of people think, oh, you know, everybody has the same opportunities and it's not a real thing. I've heard that plenty of times. but that's not the case.
Yeah.
So this is really cool that you're really diving in and sharing the stories and the data saying, hey guys, this is a problem and it's a problem that needs to be addressed.
Sure.
There's so much that so many ways you could go. So I know you work a lot in the DEI space and the organizational development space. What inspired you? Like one day, did you just like wake up and say, hey, this is a problem I need to write about it? Or what inspired you to kind of start down this road?
So I've been doing racial equity work probably the better part of almost 30 years now. And so starting out in healthcare, looking at the challenges in communities of color, specifically Black and Brown people, and the challenges that they were having in accessing healthcare, getting quality healthcare. And then also we recognize that Black and Brown people often, even when they do have access to healthcare and have insurance, they still get sicker and die sooner. And so that's where I started my journey into healthcare as a nurse, later as a public health professional, and then ultimately going on to develop and implement policy as it related to access to care for vulnerable communities, communities of color, ensuring that they had access to medication, to the healthcare system, to prevention methodology, to medications, services, ancillary services, not just healthcare, but all of those wraparound services as well that ultimately can help them have a better quality of life. And so that really set the stage and the foundation for me to be doing this work that we call today DEI. So we did not necessarily call it that, you know, back then. It's been called so many different things, to be completely honest. And actually, to be honest, like right now, we're even challenged with what the name is. So, you know, there are the conversations about going back to calling it diversity management, which is what it was called probably about 40, 50 years ago. So yeah, so that's pretty much, you know, kind of my journey as I've got here and really just recognized that not only does money and the wealth gap impact healthcare, but it impacts the well-being just all the way around of communities of color, Black and Brown people. And so, you know, the work that I do now, the research really looks at the challenges in corporate America that Black women have, specifically Black and Brown women, challenges that they have in terms of breaking through the glass ceiling. So, well, we know right now there are only two Black women CEOs that are on the Fortune 500, and there's only one on the S&P. And so that becomes a significant challenge when you talk about decreasing the wealth gap, because if you only have two that are on the Fortune 500, one on the S&P, then what does that really mean for the other women who are in corporate America who are trying to obviously better not only themselves, but their families and ultimately their communities?
Yeah, and I could see that. The question I have here, right, because this is what I hear a lot of white people talking about, right? Their first thing will be like, well, see, then they made it. We have Black CEOs, so then they made it. So then why are we talking about this in this way, right? I don't know if you've heard that before from white people. I know I have. And I'm just like, I look at them strange and I'm like, but there's like two.
Right.
How many companies are there? And there's like two? And like you said, there's only one on the S&P. It's like, how does that make any sense?
Right.
But you hear this kind of rhetoric and I would say even stupidity from white people because they're like, well, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
But it is, right? And going back to like your other work in healthcare, it's like people are dying because they can't get the healthcare they need to be able to survive. And there's a lot of things here that go unseen in these different systems that don't support the Black and Brown communities at all.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. To your point about this whole idea of making it, what does that really mean, right? Because two CEOs on the Fortune 500, that's not even 1%. So there's that. And then only one on the S&P. But then the bigger issue is that one of the things that we see is that there is, you know, what we call the phenomenon of the broken rung. So the broken rung refers to the fact that it's difficult to even get from entry level to middle manager. So if you can't get from entry level to middle manager, then there's no way that you can even advance or impact the wealth gap at all. And so we see that as well, you know, with Black and brown people, Black and brown women specifically. And so a lot of that has to do with a lack of access to opportunity. So even though you do see individuals who are in corporate America, they don't have the access to the social networks and to the professional networks that would provide them with the opportunities to advance. And so, you know, when you talk about education, Black women specifically are the most educated group on the planet. So, you know, Black women tend to have degrees upon degrees upon degrees, because often, you know, there's this idea that we need more degrees in education to be better, to be able to get to that place. Then you start seeing things like the increase in student loan debt, right? And so therefore you have to work in a certain industry to be able to get beyond that student loan debt. So, I mean, it's a multifactorial issue and there are a lot of challenges, but I think the first thing that needs to kind of occur is really looking at, well, first, just having the conversation, right? So there's having the conversation and this making people aware and making people understand that there are still systems in place. There are still barriers in place that relate to a lack of power and privilege, which is why you cannot decrease the wealth gap. We know right now that 400 years of slavery, ultimately, in order to close the wealth gap, we'd need another 400 years is basically what it comes down to. And so recognizing that we would not see that in, you know, in your or my lifetime, our children or even our grandchildren's lifetime.
Huh, that's interesting. I never thought of it from that perspective. And even that 400 years, like, because it makes my brain start thinking, even with the inequality that we see out there, you think after 400 years, it would still even out? Because there's a lot of like lost opportunity that the Black and brown community don't even have, right? So that's kind of where my brain goes, because we're not even on an equal playing field to begin with.
No.
Or even an equitable playing field, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, to me that it seems like probably not long enough, but maybe I'm wrong.
That's, you know, what the economists say. So, you know, there's a number of think tanks, and that's pretty much what they say, is that 400 years of slavery, and that's if we're looking at the current trajectory of things. So it would take another 400 years. But again, you know, circumstances, situations, you know, obviously could increase or decrease that amount of time. But let's just say conservatively, it's 400 years.
A long time, right? I mean, that's really what we're saying here. It's going to take generations upon generations because of the oppression and the lack of opportunity, right? The continued racism that exists within the systems themselves,
sure.
Right? Those systems are very problematic and don't support these communities that have been oppressed for so long. Sure. It's unfortunate. Through my own journey of looking at myself as a white man in America, it's been a long journey. I'm still learning, and there's a lot that I'm like, wow, we really messed up. And there's a lot we got to do to change how we can, you know, start leveling this playing field and taking the advantage away, because it's not fair, right? It's not fair. People suffer and continue to suffer. If we really call ourselves humans and really look at like, how can we as a human race all move ahead together in a way that helps everybody out? We get in this space of too much scarcity, I guess, in some of that. I don't know, just lots of conversations I've had with different people. I'm like, oh, that's interesting that you think that way, because just for them to have means you don't get to have. Like, that doesn't make sense. You know, you talk about the wealth gap with Black women in business. And I saw in my career, right? My career was IT, and I saw a lot of things happen, right? But that mentality of, oh, if we're going to promote them, that means somebody else doesn't get promoted. Or if they get a raise and somebody else isn't raised. It's this weird corporate math that happens, right? That's unfortunate, because it means, well, for somebody else to have, then that means you can't have. I don't personally, that's not my belief.
Right.
Right. I believe that we can all prosper together.
Yeah.
It's always been frustrating to me to see that happen. Honestly, again, in my naivety, like not even being aware of how much harder it is for the Black and brown community to even get there. You're saying like the broken rung. It's a very fascinating concept, because I could see it now, right? Where before I couldn't, where I was completely like just oblivious to it, you know, and that's again, my own ignorance. So women who are in this space, right, are entry level trying to hit middle management. What's the likelihood of them getting there, or what can they do to help themselves, you know, start to minimize that wealth gap? Is there like one thing? Is there like a handful of things? What can people do?
Yeah, you know, it's multifactorial. There are so many challenges there because the gatekeepers, in order for them to get to the next level, are often individuals who don't look like them. And so, you know, the phenomenon is people hire people who look like them, right? And so therefore, you have to have people who are advocating for you, people who want to sponsor you. Really, there's just a need for more just allies. So it's not, you know, that they don't have the knowledge, the skills and ability, but they don't have the access, the opportunity. And so some of that is them creating their own kind of pathway. So some are fortunate to be able to have mentors who have sponsors who are able to put them in front of the right people in the right spaces and places for them to meet individuals who see their potential and are in a decision-making role. So, you know, I think that's one part of it. I think the other part of it is for those individuals to make their own ways as well. And so some of that has to do with increasing your profile. So I'll just give you an example. You know, I had a woman tell me that one of the ways that she increased her profile is in her community, she joined a bunch of boards. And so, you know, she was very, very committed to her community. And so as a result, she ended up being not the Washington Business Journal, but the Business Journal in her city. And so what she would do is every time she was in a journal or in an article, you know, the newspaper, she would send that to her colleagues in her company. And she would say, hey, you know, just wanted to share this with you. These are some of the things that we're doing in the community. And what ended up happening was those gatekeepers, those decision makers were just like, huh, this woman is really something else. We need to pay more attention to her. And then what ended up happening was she subsequently got the right meeting with the right person and they subsequently put her in the right role. And like she's a senior vice president at a financial institution on the wealth generating side. And so she is forward facing, you know, bringing in money and those types of things. And so she got the opportunity, but there's still things that need to happen, right? So that's just one example of how you're able to get to that outward facing role or to a place where people begin to notice you.
That's cool for her. And I just want to call out for the white people listening to this, look at all the extra she had to do just to be able to get the opportunity, right? And I think that's from the white community. That's what we don't ever realize. The extra work, the extra things that have to happen for her specifically, but you know, the general community to be able to even get ahead, to be seen. Because I know in my career, I just had to show up and do a good job. I didn't have to go join a whole bunch of boards. I didn't have to promote myself and sell myself over and over and over every day to be able to get promotions and find things, right? I just went and got some skills. I've become really good at it. And then I just applied and my name sounds very white. So it's like, oh, cool, this guy, right? And then they see me and I just fit right in.
Sure.
You know, like you're saying, we hire people who look like us.
Sure.
And so it was never a problem. You know, again, back to always try to be super honest with this. I always thought like, oh, everybody with my same skill set has the same opportunities, right? Especially in my career. It's IT, it's just computers, man. Everybody has the same opportunities. Except for everywhere I always worked, we're mostly just white men. Sometimes some white women and sometimes some men of color, but
yeah,
outside of that, not much else.
Sure. The meritocracy does not exactly work that way for people of color, for Black and brown people specifically, because as I said, you know, we tend to be overeducated, more educated than the general population. And so on one hand, you would think that, oh, wow, you've got all this education, you've got these skills, you've got the experience. And so therefore, that should make you promotable. And unfortunately, that's not the case. It's really about, you know, who you know, how you know them. This is even individuals that have the right, quote, pedigree. So, you know, you've gone to the right schools, you've done the Ivy League thing, or you've gone to an amazing institution, right? And you've got the undergrad, you've got the business degree, you know, maybe you even got a doctorate or JD. And so still the meritocracy is broken because you would think that you would be able to continue to advance, be promoted. But again, it's not about what you know, it's about who you know.
Yeah. And I look at that, like that brings up this, you know, as I'm thinking like this whole conversation of wealth gap, I look at that and I'm like, in my corporate career, I did go to college, but I dropped out after like two semesters. It was boring to me, right? I couldn't handle it. I had a skill set, right? I joined the IT crowd in like the late 90s. So it was hopping right then, right? It was a perfect time to enter that field. It didn't require a bunch of the other stuff. And it just worked my way up. Found a skill set that was very specific. I could kind of name my price where I went. I made a lot of money and I never went to college. Mm-hmm. And then going back to, you know, what you said earlier, just looking at all the, I would say, the accomplishments and receipts that Black women need to be able to increase their perceived value. And so people see them. That right there, like I don't have student loans. I never went to college. I never took out student loans. So right there, I'm already ahead of those who went to college and had to do student loans and had to get all these degrees and all these things just so they could actually get a job that was just as good as mine.
Exactly.
I guess I'm just putting two and two together here, right? That just blows my mind, right? I didn't have to worry about that. And here they are under mountain loads of debt just to kind of get where I got to. And now we're perceived equal because, hey, look, you're both doing well. Right. But it's all that behind the scenes stuff that we don't even take into account. We just assume everybody has it. But I'm like, again, I didn't do the college thing. I don't have student debt. It's not a thing that always will be there for me.
Absolutely.
That just blows my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you look at student loan debt, like student loan debt, when you have a six figures in student loan debt, that amount of debt is actually crippling, right? And so even if you do make a lot of money, it's the paying back that debt. It then becomes this kind of, you need to have a debt to income ratio that is whatever it needs to be so that you can survive. So whether that means, you know, you buy a house or you're able to, you know, get credit. I mean, there are just so many things that impact the wealth gap when it comes to Black and brown people, specifically Black and brown women. There's still a little bit of a disparity between, you know, Black and brown men and Black and brown women if we were to look at the paradigm. So there's definitely some inequities, you know, with Black women, you know, making 64 cents on the dollar, you know, Black men, you know, making 75 cents on the dollar. So there are things like that that come into play as well. But the wealth gap tends to widen as well because Black women also tend to be caretakers, right? So they have children and other people that they need to care for. So therefore, makes, again, the wealth gap continues to widen.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a complex topic. As we're talking, right, I see all these like service level things that definitely can help the situation. But again, just the inequality, the inequitability of where you're at. And like you just said, what the difference between, and that's the crazy part to me too. So what you just said, how much they make on like what the perceived dollar is, right? 64 cents. That's crazy. That's almost half. Mm-hmm. Almost half. This floors me. Again, back to my example I used before, like I have no student debt. Like there was a Black woman who had the same job as me. She's still going to make 40% less than I am just because she's a Black woman. Mm-hmm. Just blows me away. Man, as I sit with it, right, when in my current space where I'm at, it becomes infuriating to me because I'm like, why? Why the inequality that happens? Pay people, it just makes me angry. That's all. Pay people for the job they're doing and make it fair to everybody, right? This is what the job is. And I know that that's a whole different conversation in the corporate world about pay transparency and all of that. And I like that some companies are embracing that.
Sure.
There's a lot of them that still aren't, right? Where it becomes, you know, dangerous to talk about your wage.
Yeah,
I never knew that. Like growing up, I always talked to my coworkers about how much I made because I was always, I don't know, in the beginning of my IT career, I was doing as much as like the seasoned guys. And I knew as much because I had done a lot of self-study on my own, been into computers like well before I entered the corporate world and found out I was making like half of what some of them were, which was cool at the time for me because the guys I worked with were like me, again, a bunch of white guys. They really liked me. And so they banded together and they got me actually like a 30% raise 1 year. It was really cool, right?
Yeah.
But how many of us are actually doing that in the places where we work? You talked about the gatekeepers and getting past them, but how much do people feel like they can talk about what they're making? Which I know very few don't because the corporate cultures out there really kind of try to squash that. They don't want an uprising of the employees, right? They don't want people knowing what other people make because it might make them feel better. Who knows what, all kinds of different stories I've heard.
In the Black community, typically we don't talk about money and we definitely don't talk about how much we make. But I think that that is changing with the millennials and Gen Z because there are many more of them that are kind of in tech and venture capitalists and things like that. And so this whole idea of pay transparency, I would say that they're making it more accessible, you know, in addition to just the whole issues around just pay equity and corporations wanting to make sure that it's balanced. But there's a whole phenomenon around pay and pay transparency so that people of color actually can ask for what they're worth. I mean, there are websites, you know, a lot of them are in the tech world where people, you don't know who you're talking to, but you can ask them questions about, you know, salary within an organization and things like that. So I do think that there are more people who are talking about pay. And I think the more we have those conversations, the better off we are, because you don't know what you don't know. And so, you know, many times individuals, particularly those people who are of color, you know, maybe they are first generation college educated, maybe they're the first to be in corporate America, maybe they're the first to be a business owner. And so you don't necessarily know, you know what your services are worth, right? Or what you think that they should be worth.
Yeah.
But oftentimes, what you think they're worth and what they're really worth, there's a huge gap.
Yes, 100%.
And so that's where the conversations come into play in terms of talking to other people and saying, okay, well, this is what I want to do. You know, I heard two interesting stories recently, and I told both of these Black women that they undervalued themselves. I had one woman in the government told me that she was getting a promotion, and the promotion was like to a 14, and I guess she'd been a 13. And so I said, well, what did you ask for? She was just like, oh, I just took what they gave me. And I was like, well, why would you do that? And she was just like, well, it's more than what I've been making. And I was just like, okay, so you do know that you could have asked for probably 30% more. And she was just like, really? And I'm like, yeah. And so she was like, well, you know, it's too late now. But again, you know, this is what I'm talking about. She's just like, nobody told me how to negotiate. I've never learned that. You know, I'm the first in my family to be college educated and have a good job. And, you know, and even none of my friends are even telling me these things that you're telling me, because, you know, our friends are kind of in the same place as her. And so that was just kind of a lesson. And then the other story that I had is, you know, another friend in the medical field. She's a physician assistant, and she's telling me that the corporation, you know, I guess the going rate is maybe it's $90 an hour or 100 or something. And, you know, this corporation who wants her to do urgent care, they want her to quit one of her PRN jobs because it's competition. And so they want to pay her $100 an hour. And I said, well, here's what my suggestion is. I was like, you have to understand how they make up the pay rate. So it's an hourly, then it's your benefits and all of these things that are on top of it. I said, you should probably ask them for $150. And she was just like, oh my God, do you think so? And I was just like, yeah, because they're probably going to come back with $125, which is more than the $90 that they initially offered you. And so she was just like, oh my God, I can't believe that. And so she's like, well, I need to make a decision and ask them. And I said, absolutely. And I said, this is the problem. We don't understand that we often undervalue ourselves, because I promise you, somebody else would come in and they wouldn't have any problems with asking for $150, and they would get it.
Yeah, 100%. And it's true. We don't normalize the money conversation at all.
Yeah.
I remember it was a long time into my career when I finally figured out that I could also negotiate my wage when I got a raise, even internally in an organization. People don't know this. So if you're listening to this and you haven't done this before in your career, like, you can negotiate your rate. You really can. And I think that's the thing. We've been programmed that we're just so thankful to have a job that then when we find a promotion, we've worked so hard for the promotion.
Yeah.
We have no idea, because there's no pay transparency, that we don't know. It's just like, well, I'm making this much. And like, you know, the one lady you're talking to, well, it's more than I'm making now, so I'm happy. But are you going to be happy in like a year or 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to come back and get you eventually. It wears on you, right? And the coaching I do on the money side, it weighs on us. And I love that you're having these conversations and pushing these people, you know, right? These clients of yours, because it's, again, like this money conversation, we don't have enough. We're too scared of it. It's been taboo for too long that we have to normalize it, because if not, then especially this wealth gap is going to continue to just get bigger and bigger. People are just going to continue to take the small raises and get more work and do more promotion, because guess what? The companies benefit from that, right? I'm going to pay you less, you're going to do more, and I'm happy. But it doesn't promote good health for you.
Sure.
And you're not going to find a good balance at work, because it's going to weigh on you over and over and over. The second one is funny too, negotiating that rate and going higher. Like, I did that for one job one time. I went there, I changed jobs, and it was my own stupidity, because I went from living in Utah to living in Maryland, and there's a huge a huge increase in cost of living. I didn't go for enough money. But for me, it was like a huge raise, right? I got like at that point in time, I went from what I was making to what I was making at the new job was like a $30,000 a year raise. Like that felt good. But again, not taking into cost of living and things like that, like that was not enough money at all.
Sure.
You know, so when my contract ended, I negotiated and I went in super high. I'm like, this is what I want. And they thought I was crazy. And so we met somewhere kind of in the middle. But I was happy and I still got more than what they wanted to offer me. Like I ended up with another like $20,000 than what they wanted to offer me. But again, if you don't know and you just take it, then you're just going to be there and you're going to continue to fall behind where you need to be. That's important.
Very true. Yeah. We need to learn how to negotiate. But you know, the bigger thing is we need to have those conversations and those conversations really start at home. So, you know, if you're able to have those conversations at home, you have children, you know, family members, start having them earlier, sooner than later, and helping people to understand the value of money and what you're worth. Then, you know, when you get out into the working world, it becomes a situation in which the conversation is normalized.
Yeah. And back to, you know, a lot of the people that you've interacted with are first generation of something, right? College graduates or in the working world, or maybe in the stage of their career, might be the first time that it's the first person in their family who's like hit middle management or even upper management, if they can make it that far. Who do they go to, right? There's nobody in their family they can go talk to. I've had some conversations in my money coaching business with individuals, a couple of Black women, where they're like, I don't know what to do. That's why I'm coming to you, because I don't have anybody in my family I can talk to.
Yeah.
It's a real problem. So finding mentors and people that have been there or can help you, kind of like yourself for your clients, right? And the people that you mentor, because I know you mentor a lot of people as well. It's invaluable, right? To have those resources of people who have been along that path before you, so they can kind of give you some pointers to say, hey, it's not as scary as it feels. It's not as tough. And you can ask for more, because that's okay.
It's really required. To be completely transparent and honest, I can say that I have had challenges asking for, you know, my worth as well. So here I am, got all of these degrees, and I'm just like, oh, wait a minute. I had to have somebody in my life say, you're undercharging. I'm like, oh my God, really? And some of it has to do with not even necessarily myself, but understanding who I serve. So if the majority of the people that I serve are Black and brown, and I know that there's a wealth gap in our community, I'm also sensitive to that, right?
Yeah.
But then what this person told me, and I had to realize, those aren't your clients then. If those people can't afford to pay what you're worth, like truly what you're worth, then those are probably not your clients. You need to think of like a tiered approach. And so this is actually something else that I've kind of thought of, because, you know, to your point, you know, I do mentor a lot of people. I do mentor a lot of young professionals, and I want them to be able to afford my services as well, right? So now I've kind of got like this tiered approach. So if you're between like 1 and 10 years in your career, then my rate is this. But if you're 10 years above, then my rate is this. And it's actually interesting, because this is what they do on the educational side, like from the alumni perspective in terms of giving. Philanthropy does this. They're like, if you graduated between 1 and 5 or 1 and 10 years, then you're here. But if you're 10 years above, then you have this ability. And so that's kind of the way that I'm thinking as well, because I do want to make my services accessible to everyone, because I believe, A, I have a good product. But B, there's a need. But sometimes when you're just getting out of school, you don't have it, right? So you don't have the $10,000 a month that I might charge somebody who's been in their career, you know, 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. I like that. That's really cool, because it is. If we want to see change, and I do something similar with some people who have at different times, right? Looking at like, okay, what can you do, right? Because I know these services, I know what you do is super important. So if you can help those who don't have the resources but are willing, right, that can get there, now you're just helping, you know, move everybody forward, and it feels equitable to you as well, right?
Sure.
And I think that's important, especially in business. And when we look at this, yeah, we're trying to cut down the wealth gap, but how can we do that to support our communities? Mm-hmm. And it still has to feel equitable to us as the ones providing the services, because if not, then we're going to burn ourselves out. Then who does that serve? It doesn't serve anybody at the end.
Right. Absolutely. That's absolutely it.
That's cool. I do have one more question for you, because this is a question that came up earlier.
Sure.
People listening to this, right? People like me, white men, who are normally, we're going to say stereotypically, the gatekeepers within corporation. What would you say, what can they do to help minimize the complexity of Black and brown women moving up the corporate ladder?
I think opportunity, you know, creating opportunities for them to be seen and heard. But the creating opportunities, that doesn't mean free labor. When I say creating opportunities, oftentimes what ends up happening is Black and brown women take on more projects. So they take on, you know, the DEI, and they're on this committee and that committee. And a lot of that is without compensation, right? And it's more so for notoriety or for them to be seen and heard. So I think if there are opportunities that men, white men can create for them to be seen and heard and compensated at the same time, that is very helpful and will ultimately help them get to the next level. But I think the bigger issue is when you see talent, like nurture that talent, be a sponsor. One of the things we know is that Black and brown women specifically are over mentored. So they don't need mentorship. What they need is sponsorship. They need people who are the decision makers, who are able to cut checks, sign checks, write checks, put people on projects and things like that. That's what they need. So they need the sponsorship, the individuals who are able to make the introductions to the higher ups, to the CEOs, to the executive leadership team, and nurture them and nurture those relationships. Because I think that's the other piece that's really important. So some of it is once you get to that place, because there's no one there that looks like you, you're kind of fumbling around and you don't really know what to do, how to do it. So I think that's the other part. It's not just doing the introduction, but it's also the nurturing, the educating. So even though you're sponsoring that individual, letting them know, okay, these are the things you need to say. These are the things you need to do when you go into these rooms, when you meet these individuals, you know, say XYZ or use XYZ. I have a great story, and I'm going to end with this story about a very good friend of mine who was in the financial services industry, worked on Wall Street for years, handsome guy. And, you know, he was told when he was on Wall Street, use your charm, use the fact that you're handsome to get the things that you need. And, you know, here he's a young guy and he's just like, what do you mean? And this is like, you know, this is like a white woman and a white man that told him this. And they're just like, this is how you get into the rooms. They're like, you already have, you know, you're super intelligent. You've got the background. Now there are other skill sets to use. And so he did that and, you know, did well on Wall Street. And if you look at individuals who are in financial services, most of them are attractive anyway. There's something to be said about that. How you dress, how you look, whether or not you're well-groomed, there's this whole idea of there's another way to get to the next stage when you are of color and you have all of these other things. And I'm not advocating at all utilize your attractiveness or your charm or any of those things. But what I am saying is that, you know, we do recognize that there are disparities, right? And so there are things that get you ahead. I mean, and I've heard that in my research in terms of who got ahead and why they got ahead, how they were dressed, how they looked, etc. There are things like that. But, you know, helping people, if you are a sponsor of a person of color, really helping them to navigate those spaces and places, those conversations. Golf is another thing that I heard. Learn how to play golf, right? This colleague that I mentioned, this person that I spoke with, she very much was just like, I learned how to play golf because early on I realized that deals were made on the golf course and I am in financial services. And so it was actually funny because there were all these white men that were like, oh, we're going golfing. She's like, oh, do you have another space for a fourth? And they're like, oh, you know how to golf? She was like, oh yeah, absolutely. And she was really good. You know what I mean? And so they were like, whoa.
Yeah, yep.
And so here she had more opportunities than other people would. So there are things that you do need to learn how to do. You need to know how to navigate those spaces and places and be able to talk about a multitude of things so that you can be accepted in many of those crowds.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like you said, Black and brown women are kind of over-mentored, but the sponsorship, right? And I hope people heard what you said there, right? Because what I take away from it is it needs more, right? There needs to be some guidance in how to navigate these rooms where you've never been.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you're just going to get there and you're going to fail. They're going to be like, hey, look, we got you here. Now you can like sink or swim, have fun, enjoy.
Yeah.
Which isn't fair as well to anybody, right? It doesn't help promote any of that. So that continued relationship building, they continue to be like, hey, this is how we navigate these areas. Because if not, then the gatekeepers provide the opportunities and they're like, well, see, it doesn't work. I know how they think, right? Because they're like, oh, see, we provided the opportunity and you didn't do well. So I guess this just isn't going to work. So we're going to go back to what we know, right?
Right.
Instead of blaming, and that's the thing, is blaming on the person they helped elevate instead of being like, oh, no, that was my fault because I didn't set you up for success once you got here.
Right.
And that's the thing. So that's what I want, specifically white men listening to this. Like, you got to set them up for success.
Sure.
Because if not, then this problem's going to continue to happen. And that's what we can't have.
Absolutely.
Because the goal really, I know for myself, one reason why I started the show is to have this conversation of like, hey, what's the intersection of money and racism? And there's lots of different ways we can talk about this because there's so many.
Yeah.
But this is one specifically, right? Where the wealth gap is so big that, like you said, for those listening, go back and remember what we said, like 400 years. And that's from like super smart people with math. And that's like best case scenario.
Yeah.
Which is just absurd to me that even best case scenario is still going to take that long to rectify the problem. Like, this is a journey. It's a marathon. Like you said, Vanessa, right? We won't see this in our lifetimes. But it's my goal to try to at least make a small splash in my space to help start trying to affect it. And, you know, hopefully it will cause some ripples.
Absolutely.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Man, this conversation has been so good. Thank you so much for being here. We could probably talk for hours. Like, there's so many places we could go with all of this. As we close up, how do people find you? Like, if they were like, hey, I like Vanessa, I want to connect with her. Like, where are you at and how can people connect with you?
Find me on LinkedIn, Dr. Vanessa Marie Perry on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. My handle is at Dr. Vanessa M. Perry. Or you can always find me online. Send me a message on my website at healthresourcessolutions.com. And my email is either Vanessa@healthresourcesolutions.com or info@healthresourcesolutions.com. I'm all over the place. So thank you.
Cool. I love that. And I'll include all those places in the show notes so people can find those and they can come find you and follow you and learn from your wisdom. You know so much.
Thank you.
Which again floors me. I know your educational background and all the degrees and all the things you have. And then, you know, for you to say to yourself that a friend had to remind you that, hey, you have to charge more because you're worth it. Like, what you do really impacts the world, and it does.
Sure.
You know, so just always a reminder to everybody that we don't necessarily need more degrees or more skills. We need a level playing field, which we're all working towards.
Yeah.
And to believe in ourselves too, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But thank you for this, Joe. It's been great having this conversation with you. And I just welcome the opportunity to just chat with your audience because this is a really important topic. You know, systemic racism, the wealth gap is a conversation that we need to continue to have on a regular basis. And I think the more we talk about it, the more people become aware about it and they're able to do what they can. So, you know, we want allies in this fight for equity, you know, and I say equity versus equality because we all have to be playing from the same playing field before we can be equal.
Yeah.
I think that's really what the key is.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And as always, you know, again, thank you so much. And I'm super excited to read your book when you have it out. So can't wait for that as well.
Thank you.
Again, thank you so much.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome. And we'll see y'all next episode. Bye. Thank you for joining us on Money and Racism. We hope we left you with something to think about. If you like the conversation, make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, please leave a review. To find out more about the psychology and emotion of money, visit www.josephmburns.com. And if you or someone you know would be a great guest for the podcast, email me at podcast@josephmburns.com. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world.